What do dwarfs, prodigies, and deaf people have in common?
In a curious way, those differences that seem so isolating are actually what unites us and the thing we most have in common.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Andrew Solomon was a child who was different from his parents, and that experience shaped him in some important ways. As an adult, he set out to find others who had experienced the sense of difference, and he found many. He's written about what he found in the book Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. This hour, we'll talk about children who are not like their parents and parents whose children are not like them. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When we have children, we expect to see a reflection of ourselves in them, a blending of the traits of the biological mother and father. But it doesn't always work that way. Andrew Solomon has written about children who are not like their parents in his book, Far From the Tree. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at the Sheridan in downtown Iowa City at 7:30 as a guest of the University of Iowa, and he's with me on the phone right now. Andrew, thank you so much for being here today.
What a pleasure.
Now, Andrew, in your book, you write about the difference between what you call vertical identity and horizontal identity. And I want to start with a definition of vertical identity. That's that thing I was talking about, where we expect to see ourselves in our kids, right?
Absolutely. So vertical identities are the ones that we have in common with our parents. One's ethnicity is usually a vertical identity. One's nationality, one's language, frequently one's religion. These are characteristics that people have in common with their parents, and it can be argued that some of them can be quite difficult, that our post-racial presidency notwithstanding, it's still easier in the United States to be a white person than a person of color, but nobody tries to cure those identities. Nobody has ever attempted to ensure that the next generation of children born to African-American or Latino parents come out with blonde hair and blue eyes. The attempt is made to change the society to make it more accepting of people with those differences. So those are the vertical identities, all of the things you've inherited from your parents, either through genetics or just through the way that you all live and the sort of absorptive process of being a child.
All right. And then to contrast with that, what do you mean by horizontal identity?
Horizontal identities are the identities that you do not have in common with your parents. And I've called them horizontal because instead of coming down in the sort of vertical process from generation to generation, you learn them from a peer group. You learn them from meeting other people with whom you have those identities in common. So being gay, for example, is a horizontal identity. Most gay kids are born to straight parents. Being deaf is a horizontal identity. Most deaf people are born to hearing parents. Most dwarfs are born to parents of full height, and so on and so forth. And so the horizontal identities are all of these ones you have to learn from a peer group that you often, you have this quality and your parents find it quite alienating. They don't know what to do with it. At some point you discover whatever the world is around the identity you have, and you may find a liberation in that. And time out of mind, people have tried to cure the horizontal identities. Straight parents with gay children find the children disorienting and often, if not even usually, have tried to get their children to function in what they think of as the real regular world. Hearing parents of deaf children have historically placed a great emphasis on lip reading and oral speech in an attempt to ensure that their children function in the so-called mainstream world. And so that push toward the mainstream is the usual experience of people with those identities.
Now, you write a lot about your own personal experience in a couple of different ways. One way is that you are dyslexic, and you write about what it was like to grow up with that learning disability and how your mother helped you cope with that. You also write about what it means to be a gay child of straight parents. And we'll talk more about your personal experience in a moment, but what was it that made you start thinking about this subject in a more general, in a broader way, beyond your own personal experience?
Well, 20 years ago, my editors at the New York Times Magazine assigned me an article about deaf culture. And I was very taken aback at the time because I had mostly been doing foreign reporting. And my editor said, this is a foreign society in our own midst. And then also because I was primarily thinking of deafness as a terrible disability, these poor people, they couldn't hear, what could we do for them? And I had no idea there was any such thing as deaf culture. And then as I went out into the deaf world, I came to think that deaf culture was very real and that it was actually very beautiful and that it was organized around the shared use of sign language as a primary means of communication. And as I threw myself deeper and deeper into that world, I became more and more attracted to it. And when I discovered that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, as I said, I was suddenly struck by how similar the experience of deaf people was to the experience of gay people. Here were these people. Their parents didn't get it about the condition they had. In adolescence or thereafter, they found community. When they found that community, it came as a great liberation. And they then negotiated their relationship with their parents around the revelations that they'd had in finding that community. So I wrote about the parallel between the deaf and the gay experience. And then a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf, and she started talking about all of her concerns. Turned out most dwarfs are born to parents of full height. She said, do I tell her she's just like everyone else but kind of short, or do I somehow get involved with the little people of America and try to construct a dwarf identity for her? And it was when she started talking about it that I suddenly thought, there it is again. There again is this situation of this alienating child, this potentially alienated child, and this family trying to do their best and figure out how they're going to give this child a sense of positive self-image and reasonable identity. And I thought, okay, if it's true for gay people, and it's true for deaf people, and it's true for dwarfs, I'll bet it's true for a lot of other people too. And that was the moment when the whole idea of the book was born.
And you have explored many different areas of differences. Can you give us an idea of the different places that you went to start exploring these horizontal identities?
Absolutely. So the book has a first chapter about my experience as the gay child of straight parents. Then it has a deafness chapter, one on dwarfism, one on Down syndrome, one on autism, one on schizophrenia, one on families of people with multiple severe disabilities. And that those first chapters are essentially about what we've tended to define as diseases. And then for the second half, I wanted to look at things that we've essentially defined as problematical identities and look at how we make sense of them. So I have a chapter on prodigies, whose families are also completely overwhelmed by having children who are so different from them. One on families bringing up children conceived in rape, because I wanted to indicate that the experience of alienation from your own child can be a result not only of what your child is like, but also of where your child comes from. A chapter on families of people who commit crimes, because I wanted to look at the idea that what your child does can also have this determinative quality. And a final chapter on people who are transgender, and then a very last chapter, which is about my experience as a gay person of becoming a parent, and the way that in having children myself, I came to re-understand all of these situations, including my relationship to my own parents.
I can imagine that there are some people who share traits with the people that you write about in your book who think, wait a minute, I'm a transgendered individual and you're comparing me to someone with Down syndrome. You know, I can imagine that there are some people who have had their feathers ruffled by this. Have you had reaction like that saying, wait a minute, I don't have a disease. Why are you writing about me?
I felt it was a mark that I was really onto something, that everyone in the book objected to the other chapters. You know, the criminal said, okay, we did some bad stuff, but we're not crazy like those transgender people. And the autism people said, but we're so much smarter than the people with Down syndrome. And the prodigies couldn't understand what they were doing in there at all. But I've had the gratifying experience since the book was published of having a lot of those same people who said, why have you put me in this book? I don't think I belong here. This doesn't make sense. Come back and say, actually, I now see that there are parallels between my experience and the experience of these other people. And when the book was published, I had a book party, and I invited as many of the people in the book as I could to come and join. And I got an email a few weeks later with a photograph that showed three people who had met at the book party. One was the father of a child with autism, one was a woman with schizophrenia, and one was a dwarf. And they had all gone out to dinner together, and they sent a note and said, we didn't think we would have anything in common, but you're right, we do. And I think in some ways the real message of the book is that you think of each of these kinds of difference as quite isolating. There are only so many families dealing with schizophrenia. There are only so many families dealing with Down syndrome. There are only so many families who have children conceived in rape. They seem like very diffuse experiences, and each of them seems quite isolating. But actually, the experience of negotiating difference within the family is something that extends to an enormous number of families, possibly at some level even to most families. And in a curious way, those differences that seem so isolating are actually what unites us and the thing we most have in common. We most have in common the fact that we all struggle with the differences within our families and figuring out how to reconcile them.
It strikes me that as you were writing about these families and the children who have these horizontal identities, you are also writing about parents who suddenly have a new horizontal identity themselves. Suddenly they are defined by being parents of a child with dwarfism or being parents of a child with Down syndrome. Their identities are radically transformed as well.
Absolutely. There are two, in effect, identity communities in each of these instances. There's the child who's directly affected, and there are the parents who are dealing with this enormous change in who they are. And I was very interested in the way in which parents start off thinking we're dealing with an illness and end up thinking we're dealing with an identity, and by the very profound ways in which they as parents undergo a shift and change in identity and become in effect different people as a result of it. The internet has become a big center for the development of community around all of these kinds of difference. 50 years ago, you had a child who was a dwarf, and it took some searching to find anyone else who had the same experience. Now you discover that you have a child who's a dwarf because of kines dysplasia, and you type that in on Google, and you immediately find discussion groups and other people who have the condition. And those groups around the identities themselves were the first ones to spring up. But very rapidly behind them there arose, on the internet as well as in real life, a lot of communities of parents. So autism parents have become a very vitalized, political, complicated, and important community. And the community of families who have children who are transgender and who attend conferences that take place to discuss the issue of having trans kids, that's enormous news. And so there's been this tremendous progress in really building communities at both levels.
I'm talking with Andrew Solomon. He has written about children who are not like their parents in his book, Far From the Tree. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at the Sheridan in downtown Iowa City at 7:30. He's a guest of the University of Iowa. He's also a writer and lecturer on psychology, politics, and the arts, and a winner of the National Book Award. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest this hour is Andrew Solomon. He is a writer and lecturer on psychology, politics, and the arts. He's also a winner of the National Book Award. And his most recent book is Far From the Tree, Parents and Children's Search for Identity. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at the Sheridan in downtown Iowa City at 7:30 as a guest of the University of Iowa. That is free and open to the public. And Andrew, just before the break, we were talking about parents and how the parents of children with these different identities also develop new identities themselves. You write about some really extraordinary parents. And I mean, clearly not every parent who is faced with a child who is so different from themselves deals with it all that well.
Absolutely. Now, to some extent, the parents who deal with it well are the ones who have enormous pride in the way they've dealt with it and are the ones most available to a journalist who's trying to write about this experience. But I also felt that the purpose of my book, in many ways, was to give people some kind of a grounding and resilience so that they would be able to function in the context of their child and their child's unusual identity. And in trying to develop and establish that model, I wanted to talk to people who had done well in the face of their challenge. But what I found as I went out into the field and did a great deal of research was that people were actually more able and resilient than one would have thought. I found that there were many people who had an extraordinary capacity to stretch and to grow in the face of these difficulties. And I found that many parents had to do it because they had these children. They were going to have to deal with these children. And if they couldn't find strength and meaning in the experience, they were going to be utterly defeated by it. And so I saw that there really were a lot of them who did rise to the occasion. Some of them were more articulate about it than others, but I found that most parents, not all, but most parents actually love their children, and most parents who love their children try to do the best they can for their children, and most of the parents who are doing that ultimately end up creating some kind of meaningful construction around the situation of their child.
In writing this book, you also spent a great deal of time thinking about your relationship with your parents. And I mentioned earlier in the program, you are a gay man, so you were a gay child of straight parents. You also had dyslexia, and I'm struck. Now, of course, people who haven't read your book might not equate dyslexia with gayness, but these are differences that you had from your parents. And I'm struck by the very different way that your parents approached your dyslexia and later your sexual identity as well. And with the dyslexia, I mean, let's talk about how your mom in particular dealt with that.
My mother had been a teacher before she got married, and she realized when I was very little that I had certain challenges, and she worked incredibly closely with me on reading. I was quite a verbal child. She knew I was interested in language and in words, and she sat with me for hours every day doing reading, and she made it into a big game, and we had a lot of fun doing it. And I remember those as sort of wonderful experiences in my childhood. When I was applying to first grade, or my family was applying to first grade in the New York City school system, I was turned down by 10 schools on grounds that I would never learn to read or write. And I've had many problems in life, but that is not one of them. I learned to read and write and do quite well. But I think in some ways that the skill with which she was able to resolve, or at least to help me to compensate for the challenges of dyslexia, set the stage for an attempt in some sense to resolve my homosexuality, and that while the dyslexia could in fact be mastered, the gayness couldn't. And I've said in the book, and I truly believe it, if it had turned out that my gayness could be made to go away fairly readily and fairly easily, and that the dyslexia couldn't, I would have an identity as a dyslexic instead of an identity as a gay person. They were both in some sense perceived neurological differences, and the attitude toward them both was actually very much the same. It was, gee, we have a problem here, what can we do about it? And I think all parenting involves figuring out what are the things about your child you can fix or improve, and what are the things about your child you need to accept and celebrate. And I think it took a while for my family to figure out which were which.
As you were coming of age, there were many people who suspected your sexual identity. You were teased, and there were teachers at school who also either joined in on the teasing or offered a kind of support for you. But you were discovering your identity at a very frightening time to discover that you were gay. I mean, there were teachers at your school who were losing their jobs.
Absolutely. And it was a very homophobic society. And I did feel when I was younger that being gay was a tragedy. I don't feel that way anymore at all, and that's partly because I've changed, and it's partly because the world around me has changed. But when I was growing up, yes, I was the butt of terrible teasing. I remember at one point there was someone on our school bus who nicknamed me Percy as a shorthand for what he saw as my unmasculine demeanor, and sometimes I would sit on the school bus and the other kids would chant, "Percy, Percy, Percy, Percy," for 45 minutes all the way up to school, all the way back, while I sat there sort of vainly trying to pretend that it wasn't happening. And when I was in eighth grade, our science teacher told us that all male homosexuals develop fecal incontinence because they had trauma to their anal sphincter. And there's just a lot of misinformation and bizarre stuff and cruelty that I encountered and had to deal with. It was enormously painful. And the journey from there to where I am in my life now is really, it's not the story that's sort of specifically focal in the book, which deals with many other things, but it informed the way I understood all of these other situations of people with unwelcome identities and how their families and how the larger society responded to them.
When did you first know that you were gay?
That's an interesting question. When did I first know that I was different? I knew that really early on. I remember being a kid who just was interested in different things and wanted to do different things than the other kids I knew did. You know, other boys were trading baseball cards, and I was really interested in opera, and I just was different in all kinds of ways. I don't think I conceived it as being gay or as a kind of sexuality until I was considerably older. I mean, I think the sense of being different had kicked in by the time I was in first grade, and I think the sense of being gay didn't really take hold until I was probably 13 or 14. And I battled against it, and I ended up having various relationships with women and so on. And so the acceptance really and truly, okay, this is who I am, and I'm not going to shift or change it, that was something I think I didn't get to until probably I was in my early 30s.
Well, and I want to talk about this because your parents, again, they accepted that you were different. And you have some wonderful anecdotes about the things that your mother would do to support your difference and your obsessions. I mean, with, for example, Liechtenstein, which is an unusual obsession for a child. And you were in Europe. She actually planned a day trip because you were so fascinated. And yet, when it came to your sexual identity, that was a difference that they just really couldn't accept for a long time.
Right. It's important that we add for a long time. It certainly felt like a long time to me. In retrospect, I feel like parents have trouble accepting the ways in which their children are different, and it didn't take my parents so hideously long, all things considered, but it was certainly painful while we were going through it. I did have these eccentric interests, and I, for some reason, and I don't even know why, but I was fascinated by giant countries and tiny countries, and I was really interested in both China and Liechtenstein on grounds that they represented those extremes, but especially focused for a while on Liechtenstein and trying to understand what went on in Liechtenstein and what people did there. And so we were on a family trip in Switzerland, and my mother announced that she had arranged for us to do a day trip to Liechtenstein. I was probably 10 or 11 years old at the time. And I remember that heady feeling of thinking everyone was going to do this just because it was an interest of mine, which was a very wonderful and exciting feeling. And I felt like, you know, if I wanted to read books that were not really what people my age mostly read, that was great. And if I was really interested in opera, my father was a big opera buff, and I was indulged in all of that. But then when I was gay, I think there were two issues for my parents, one of which was that they genuinely thought that it wasn't a very happy thing to be. You know, they felt that gay people didn't form the same kind of relationships, never got married, were socially excluded, couldn't have children, all of the things that were in fact true of being gay at that time. And so they were worried that it was going to be a painful, terrible life for me, and they wanted to save me from it. But additionally, I think my mother in particular was perfectionistic, and she saw my being gay as something of an imperfection within our family, and she didn't relish the identity herself of being the mother of a gay child. She relished the privacy that came of having children who were successful according to the general standards of the world outside. And I think that was therefore a trauma for her, both in her concern for me and in her concern for herself.
I'm talking with Andrew Solomon. His most recent book is Far From the Tree, Parents and Children and the Search for Identity. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. And Andrew, I am struck by in thinking about my own experience as a parent. For example, when I discovered that I was having a daughter, I had this panic that, oh no, she's going to have to go through all of the things that I had to go through. And I had a very happy life. So, I mean, these are minor problems. However, if I had thought, oh no, she's going to have to go through far worse things, far more difficult things than I ever have had to go to. I can imagine the terror that I would have felt. And you are writing about parents who did have to think that and feel that way. So the fear that you write about with all of these parents, I mean, is incredibly understandable.
Right. And I think they've all gone through a period of being fearful, and then bit by bit, they've gone, in effect, through three phases. They start off outraged by having a child who's different in these various ways, outraged and horrified. And then they move on to being bewildered and trying to make sense of and understand it. And then many of them ultimately move on to being celebratory and to feeling that they wouldn't change this child for any other child in the world, which is the way, frankly, that most parents, I think, feel about their children. Most parents don't want to give up the children they have for other better children. There's a sociologist who said that we not only take care of our children because we love them, but also love them because we take care of them. And the process of having children who have these differences and facing up, as you've described it, to the universal experience of parenting, which is recognizing that your children will suffer and that you have to be able to tolerate that and to support them through it, that actually is a very bonding experience, and these families end up having very deep emotional connections in the best circumstances. Some families obviously fall apart in the face of these things. But those were the stories that I was looking at. But yes, I think it's the terrifying thing of being a parent. And as a parent myself, I see it all the time, the sense that you have to allow your children to make their own mistakes, to have their own experiences. You have to help figure out what the ways are for them to cope with problems that you would prefer to make go away.
You write about a family. Megan and Michael are the parents of a deaf child. His name is Jacob. And at one point, someone actually told Jacob's mother that the kindest thing they could do would be to give Jacob to a deaf family.
The deaf community in particular, though the autism community as well, can be very paternalistic in that regard. They feel as though these children are the next generation of people like them, and their impulse is to want to say, give those people to us to be part of our world. I talked before about the horizontal identity experience of discovering the community of people who are like you. It mostly comes relatively late. It comes in adolescence or afterwards. A lot of people who are within these communities feel like if you think your child is deaf, give him to deaf parents to raise. If your child is a dwarf, why don't you find some dwarfs to bring your child up? They'll be able to construct his identity better than you can. I don't believe that. I mean, I believe people's identity is usually best formed by their family of origin, and that disrupting families in that way would obviously be a radical and bizarre idea. But I think the families have to figure out a way that they can convey the values and feelings and positions of their own family and also expose the child to the values and feelings and point of view of the community to which the child will ultimately belong, at least in some considerable part.
I find the story about deafness to be fascinating because in a way, and I guess, again, there are similarities between all of these, but you know, you are a part of gay culture, which your parents have never experienced. With deaf culture, you're bringing a child into the world who is almost from a foreign country in some ways. They will grow up if without cochlear implants or, you know, whatever, but they could conceivably grow up speaking a different language and really having a very different culture from the culture of their parents.
One of the mothers said, we had to face a choice. Either we were going to become a signing household, in which case our child would communicate fluently and we would communicate with enormous difficulty, or we were going to remain an oral household, in which case we could communicate fluently and our child would communicate with enormous difficulty. And we decided that it was the role of parents to accept the difficulty and to try to make things easier for our child, and so we became a signing household. It's a choice that many parents have to make, and the deaf community provides, because of the language issue, a particularly stark example of it. But in every one of these cases, how much do we become a household that changes its values and changes its way of doing business in the world in order to align with the interests of our child, and how much do we pull our child toward our way of doing things? And I I saw people struggling with that over and over and over again.
And with many of these differences, the parents need to make a choice at some point where they say, we are going to stop trying to fix this and focus on raising a healthy child.
Exactly. And that's also an interesting crossover point. You know, all of us do a certain amount of fixing of our children. It would be neglect not to do so. We educate them. We teach them what things to eat and what not to eat. We try to instill moral values. You can't skip doing all of those things that change your child. And all of us, to some degree, have to accept our children for who they are because our children have some immutable characteristics. So you can't spend your whole life saying to your child with brown eyes, gee, I wish you had blue eyes, I prefer blue eyes. Your child has brown eyes, and you accept your child for who he is and try to give him a sense that brown eyes are just dandio by you. But then there's a great deal of stuff that falls in the middle in a big gray area, and you don't know whether to fix and change it or whether to accept and celebrate it. And it was an question that all of these families faced over and over again, not only about the condition itself, how do I accept the fact that my child is deaf, but also about a lot of the nuances. Do I accept that my child has this point of view rather than that point of view? Do I accept this about my child or that about my child? There are all of these questions that wobble back and forth in the experience of the children.
I'm talking with Andrew Solomon. He is the author, most recently, of a book called Far From the Tree, Parents and Children and the Search for Identity. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at the Sheraton in downtown Iowa City. It's at 7:30. He's a guest of the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'm talking with Andrew Solomon. He's a writer and lecturer on psychology, politics, and the arts. He's also a winner of the National Book Award. And his most recent book is Far From the Tree, Parents and Children and the Search for Identity. He'll be giving a lecture tonight in downtown Iowa City at the Sheraton at 7:30. He's part of the University of Iowa Lecture Series. That lecture is free and open to the public. And Andrew, before the break, we were talking about the choices that parents have to make when their children are very different from themselves. And even in the first chapter of the book, you write about parents who have their children treated for having a cleft palate. And the fact that, of course, they are fixing, there are treatments now for a cleft palate that can basically take care of the problem. And if it's untreated, the child could have very serious, even life-threatening problems. And yet, the parents who get their children back after surgery to mend a cleft palate sometimes have very mixed emotions about how very different their child looks.
The experience of being a parent, by and large, is that you get attached to your child. And then sometimes when your child is radically changed, even for the better, you feel disaffected and alienated, and you have gotten used to providing the kind of care that a cleft palate requires, and suddenly your child doesn't need that care and doesn't need that attention anymore. And in the same way that many parents find the growing up of their children to be both thrilling and exciting and in some ways kind of heartbreaking, and you know, a lot of parents will sort of say, he's wonderful, but you know, I remember when he was a kid, it was also magical, and now he's an adolescent, and it's difficult. Those changes are always hard to deal with. But the change in your child from being a little kid to being an adolescent happens very gradually. The change for a child who suddenly has their cleft palate repaired happens very quickly. It's not that any of those parents wish their child hadn't had the surgery or want to go backwards or any of those things. The surgery was necessary. They know that. They recognize the ways in which it's helped them. But they still feel like, I was used to someone, and now I have someone else, and that's a difficult transition to make.
Well, let's talk a little bit about dwarfism, because there are treatments that parents can choose to have for their child. If their child is born a dwarf, they can actually have procedures done to lengthen their limbs, to make it so their child will grow to be a relatively normal height. And for some parents, this seems like a wonderful opportunity to help their child function in the world without feeling very different. At the same time, though, they have a healthy child and they would have to go through these procedures, which would be difficult and painful and make their child feel sick for a while. I mean, that must be an incredibly wrenching decision for many people. And you talk to parents about that.
We live in a time of enormous social progress in which there's more and more acceptance for people with the kinds of differences I've written about, but also in a time of great medical progress in which it's more and more possible to resolve these differences. And I was interested in the tension between those two things, and I believe in both the medical and the social progress, but some of the time I thought they should be a little bit more aware of each other than they were. Now, limb-lengthening surgeries for dwarfs are then, in some sense, in the same category as cochlear implants for deaf children. Cochlear implant is a device that's implanted in the brain, connected to a transmitter, and essentially allows sound information to bypass the structures of the ear and go directly to the sound centers of the brain. Cochlear implants strike me as a more reasonable choice. The deaf community has often been up in arms and said that they are being robbed of their next generation and that their beautiful culture is threatened, and I think all of that has some basis in reality. But I also think that the surgery is usually, though not always, there can be complications, but usually fairly straightforward, and that the children are then able to function in the hearing world, and that that is in many ways an easier life for them to go forward in. Limb lengthening is a process in which essentially the bones in the lower leg are all shattered. Screws are put through the flesh of the leg. The bone begins to knit together in the many places where it's broken. The screws are turned to pull it apart, and bit by bit, as the bone keeps trying to knit together, it grows and extends, and it can add as much as 13 inches to somebody's height. But it's excruciatingly painful. It involves being in a wheelchair for a certain length of time. It leaves scars all over the place from these screws that have gone in through the body, and it can be very brutal. Now, I've met people who've had it who've said it was the best decision they ever made, that they didn't want to be what they saw as freakish, and that they feel much happier having longer arms and legs. And I think that those options should always be available to people as long as they exist medically and are at least moderately safe. But I've also met lots of people who felt as though the idea of limb lengthening somehow threatens the validity of their identity as dwarfs. You know, it does in a way. It doesn't in some other ways. I feel like if I had had a child who was deaf, I would most likely have gotten a cochlear implant, even though I love the deaf culture, because I think that being able to hear would have allowed us to have, my child and I, to have an intimate relationship predicated on language, and I think that intimacy between parents and children is the basis of mental health. If I had a child who was a dwarf, I would not encourage that child to have limb lengthening, because I think it's such a painful procedure that it eats up a part of one's life and adolescence when one ought to be emerging into a fuller sense of who one is. And because I just think it's kind of a way of masking things. As one of the people I talked to about it who had decided not to have the procedure said, I thought about it and realized it would just make me a tall dwarf, which I thought was a wonderful construction.
We talked earlier about the different kinds of differences that you explored in the book. And there's one that seems to me quite different from the others. And that is children of rape. Because with all of the others, you're writing about something that is different about the child. With children of rape, the difference is created because of something that has happened to the mother. How does this fit in with the others?
I really wanted to look at the idea that parents have children from whom they feel alienated, and they have to go through a complicated psychological process to get to the stage at which they no longer feel alienated and are able fully to interact with and engage with the children they have. And I feel like parents who are told your child is a dwarf or your child has autism often feel totally alienated from the child, and they have to go through a long period before they think, this isn't the child I would have set out to have, but this is the child I have, and how can I be a good parent to and love this child? And that was very similar to the experience of women who'd been raped and become pregnant through rape and kept their children, and families who are now dealing with those children. The mothers wanted to love their children, but felt alienated and frightened by their children. That experience of love didn't come so readily as it otherwise might have. And I had really extraordinary conversations with people about that experience. I mean, on the one hand, I think you end up perhaps saying, as many of the parents I interviewed did, I would never have chosen to have a child with Down syndrome, but I'm grateful that I did. It gave me a richer, more purposeful life than I'd otherwise have had. I had a number of families who effectively said that. when you're looking at rape, I didn't meet anyone who said that they were glad they were raped, but I met people who had been able to build very real relationships with their children. And I think particularly of the story of one of the women I interviewed who had been brutally raped when she was 16, become pregnant through rape, had all of her career plans and indeed many of her sort of emotional and life plans derailed and pushed off in another direction. But when I met her, she was 50, and I said to her, do you think often about the man who raped you? And she said, you know, I used to think about him with anger. She said, but now only with pity. And I said, pity? And I thought she meant because he was so unevolved as to have done this awful thing. And she said, yes, pity. She said, because he has a beautiful daughter and two beautiful grandchildren, and he doesn't know that, and I do. So as it turns out, I'm the lucky one. And I thought that narrative of finding luck in an experience that was absolutely antithetical to anything that she would have wanted was very similar to the experience of many of the parents who said to me, I never wanted a deaf child, but now I've engaged with this culture and it's enriched my life more than I can say. Or parents who said, I never wanted to have a child who was transgender. It's been very upsetting and very difficult, but I've also learned and grown so much from.
I'm talking with Andrew Solomon. His most recent book is Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And Andrew, you are a father yourself, right?
Yes.
And you actually became a father while you were researching this book?
I did. And people said to me, how can you have decided to become a father in the midst of a book about everything that can go wrong? And I said over and over again, but it's not really a book about everything that can go wrong. It's a book about how much meaning one can experience even when everything seems to be going wrong and how much joy there can be even in the most difficult parenting.
Was there a moment in researching this book that helped you come to that decision? Yes, I want to be a father.
I mean, I had always wanted to have children. It had been an issue in my mind from the time that I was much, much younger. But I think that I felt, I wouldn't say there was a single moment, but I felt as I moved forward with this book that my slight fear, which was that I would have children and I wouldn't love them or wouldn't connect to them or would wish I could escape from the obligations of parenthood, was calmed by the sense that if all of these people could love all of these children, under all of these adverse and difficult circumstances, I thought, okay, then I'm going to be able to love whatever child I have.
And your child would have a horizontal identity, most likely. I mean, is that something you thought about as well? Because most children, biological children, of gay parents are straight.
Absolutely. So I assume that my children will be straight, and I have a son and a daughter, and I don't know that they will need so much help to construct their straight identity because I think the whole society helps to construct straight identity. But I feel like there will be many ways in which they have differences which are difficult for them, and I feel like I'll be equipped out of my own experience and out of the research for this book to give them the ability to claim what appears to be wrong in their life as what is right and to make good lives for themselves.
Now, I would love for you to explain for us a little bit your family structure, because it is unusual. You are married. Your husband, John, was already a father when you got married. Can you explain?
Yes. So John is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. One of my closest friends from college had gone through a divorce but wanted to have a family, and she and I decided to go forward with that. So I have a daughter with my college friend, and mother and daughter live in Texas. And then my husband and I wanted to have a child to live with us full time. And so we have our son, George, of whom I am the biological father. We had an egg donor, and our surrogate was Laura, the lesbian mother of John's two biological children.
So five parents, four kids, and a family that has a different structure than most families that we were familiar with.
Absolutely. My shorthand is five parents of four kids in three states, and it's turned out to be very joyful, and people say, wow, it's such an interesting political idea to structure your family that way. And I have to explain, it wasn't a political idea. It's the way it worked out. We all loved one one another, and in each instance there seemed to be good reasons for having the children in the way we did. And the children all have a strong sense of connectedness to one another. I mean, it was just George's spring break, and John took him for a week while I was working to Minneapolis to be with Oliver and Lucy, and he had a great time. And then we all went together down to Texas to see Blaine, and we all had a great time there. And it's turned out to be very joyful. And there seem to be people out there who think that these unorthodox structures are destroying an idea of family. And I would challenge anyone to spend time with us and think that what we've done is really evil or wrong or counter to strengthening the social fabric of the world. I feel like what we've done is a manifestation of great love, and that there's a great deal of love there, and that the children are, for so far as I can tell, extremely happy children, with their ups and downs, of course, but basically very happy children, and I think it's been a glorious thing.
You spent a lot of time in researching this book thinking about your relationship with your parents, and I'm curious about how becoming a father yourself changed your idea of your relationship with your parents.
Well, in the first place, I learned this thing that I know sounds obvious, but I think it comes as a surprise to everyone, which is that I suddenly realized how much work it is to be someone's parent. And I thought, wow, they worked really hard at this, and even if they didn't do it perfectly, they basically did a pretty good job. So that was a kind of meaningful revelation of the whole process. But I think I also understood from the book and from becoming a parent that you have dreams for your children. You have an idea of happiness, and you try to help your children arrive at the kind of happiness that makes sense to you. And that having children, you have to, in some instances, let go of what has been your idea of happiness and shift the way that you conceptualize happiness. And it's not easy to do. And I came to appreciate once I had children, I thought, oh, this thing of thinking I know how they'll be happy and I want them to do things the way that I think is best suddenly made sense to me. I think I may be able to resist it because I've had that revelation and I have that awareness, but it no longer seemed like a sort of strange and alien idea.
This book has been out for some time. It's out in paperback now, and obviously it started a lot of conversations that people want to have with you and want to have with each other, and in some ways taken off on a life of its own. What's next for you, though, beyond this?
Well, I've just signed a 3-book contract, and I'm also starting to make a documentary based on this book. So I've got my hands fairly full. 2 of the books in the 3-book contract will be collections of journalism that I've done, one of my reporting from around the world and one of interviews with people that I've done and essays on people that I've done over time. But the book will be based on my doctoral research. I was getting my PhD at the same time that I was writing Far From the Tree. And it's about the idea that in an era in which men change diapers and women work late in the boardroom, our ideas of motherhood and fatherhood are gradually merging toward a single ideal of parenthood. And how is that profound social shift reflected in gay families, in single mothers by choice, in open adoptions, and in the many other new structures that constitute family in the world we inhabit?
Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a real pleasure.
Andrew Solomon is the author most recently of Far From the Tree, Parents and Children and the Search for Identity. He'll be giving a lecture tonight at the Sheraton in downtown Iowa City at 7:30. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Horticulture Day. Now that the grass is turning green, we'll talk about lawn care. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.